Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Dash pepper, pinch of parsley, cup of chopped berry. I said chuckberry, not cranberries. Ugh, this dish is completely ruined. Music is the not-so-secret ingredient in the Schaefer Kitchen and in those of many New York restaurants. Coming up on Soundcheck today, we go behind the swinging doors to take a listen. And we want to know what's playing in your kitchen. We'll open the phones. Later. All the stars were shining bright, and then he kissed me. Singer Lala Brooks of the 60s girl group The Crystals made hits out of songs like Da Do Ron Ron and Then He Kissed Me. We'll talk with her about teen stardom and her close relationship with the late Dick Clark. All of that on Soundcheck after the news. Next time you're out for dinner, consider this. While you're listening to Vivaldi inside the restaurant, back in the kitchen, the Black Keys are on the menu. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today, what chefs really listen to while they cook. Plus a conversation with Lala Brooks of the 60s girl group The Crystals. First, though, food has become an undeniable force in pop culture, with top chefs living, looking, and behaving like rock stars. And as it turns out, many of them use music, rock, hip-hop, jazz, and more, as a key ingredient in their creations. In a moment, we'll talk with one trend-setting chef about his kitchen playlist, but first, New York Times food writer Jeff Gordonier recently wrote about how music inspires creativity in restaurant kitchens. He joins me in the studio. Jeff, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Thanks for having me.
You're making a case that music is actually kind of an ingredient. How important is it?
It turns out it's huge. I mean, if you've been in a kitchen over the last 20 or 30 years, it's not a surprise to you that chefs are pirates and that they live large and that there's a lot of music played in the kitchen, usually very volatile, mm-hmm. aggressive punk rock kind of music. But as I discovered, it's even more than that. It really informs what they do. It often influences their style of cooking and how they sort of get into the zone creatively. It even affects how they hire people. It sometimes even contributes to the overall philosophy of a restaurant. So it really is the invisible ingredient for a lot of chefs across the country.
And in Jeff's article for the New York Times, Who's Rockin' to the Music? That's the Chef. You can find a link to it on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. What gave you the idea to do this in the first place?
Well, I think it just came about largely because I've been in so many kitchens over the past year or so as I've taken on the food beat at the Times. And I started to encounter this over and over. You go out to, you know, I was hanging out with the chef Wiley Dufresne the other day at WD50. And, you know, there's all this indie rock blaring out of the kitchen. And that's just, that became a constant. And it starts to become part of the conversation with chefs about how it influences them and how important it is. And some of them simply, they feel as though they can't operate without it.
Now, when you, as you were doing this article and speaking to all these different chefs, did you notice any trends, any generational trends? Do sort of the old school chefs have a different approach to music from the current crop?
Well, I think one of the things you encounter, it has more to do with sort of the level of the restaurant, the super high-end four-star restaurants like 11 Madison Park or Alinea in Chicago. 11 Madison Park is here in New York City. No music in the kitchen. Silence. Now, the music might influence the chef in different ways in the home kitchen or in a sort of philosophical context or even a scientific context. But then with, a lot of the chefs under 40 at, you know, your small plates places, your bistros in the Village and stuff, it's Metallica, it's, you know, Tool, it's a lot of hip-hop. And, you know, it can be pretty over the top. It's usually mm-hmm. pretty loud, and it just sort of guides the groove of the kitchen.
Well, one of those chefs has also joined us on Soundcheck today, and that's Jesse Schenker, who's chef at the West Village restaurant Rosette, and evidently a Pearl Jam fan. I can see some evidence of that in the tattoo on your left arm, Jesse. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So how does the soundtrack – first of all, what is the soundtrack in your kitchen?
Well, it's tricky. I mean, we have an open kitchen, and you know, it's a quite small restaurant. But the soundtrack for us could change throughout the day. I mean, we're only open for dinner 7 days a week. So in the morning, my sous chef will come in, and you know, as he's unpacking the meat and the bones, and he needs his thing, you know, he might have Wu-Tang playing. Or
Wu-Tang Clan, okay.
You know, Method Man, Red Man. And then Christina, the pastry chef, she could roll in at 10, 11 and pop her iPod in, and, you know, it could turn into Justin Timberlake.
That's a pretty dramatic change from hip-hop to
totally
to Timberlake.
Dramatic. But solely when I get in there and it's time for me to clear my mind and really get into mode for service and we really need to, you know, pump out food, you know, I go right to 90s grunge. And, you know, that'll range from Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, Tool, Metallica, Nine Inch Nails, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's really the driving force behind us in the kitchen there.
And one of the surprises I should point out with Jesse is when I went to Reset, you know, he's delivering these incredibly exquisite, you know, elegant little dishes, and you hear these like gloomy thunderclouds of Metallica behind him. There's kind of a disconnect.
So when you say, Jesse, when you say open kitchen, it means it's one of the you don't have the swinging double
there's
doors.
There's no swinging door. There's no glass. There's no anything. There's a 24-inch partition dropping from the ceiling.
Right.
And that's it. And you could see in there. You could stick your hand through. You can hear the music. You can, you know, so if you sit at bar 5 and 6 where Jeff's at, you know, you could see what's going on in there, and you hear the dining room music, which is, you know, more appropriate for dining. I mean, you know, still rock
of.
And roll, but, you know, Foo Fighters, not as intense. But then, and, you know, if you sit close enough again, you can hear the stuff coming out of the kitchen. It's pretty interesting.
And the stuff coming out of the kitchen at the restaurant Reset sounds like this. Little Alice in Chains, Them Bones. That's kind of appropriate for a kitchen. You'll also hear Nine Inch Nails and songs like this one. And continuing with the 90s grunge theme in the Reset Kitchen, a little bit of Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam's Even Flow. So that's some of the music that'll come leaking out of the open kitchen if you're close enough to the bar, I guess, at the restaurant Reset, where Jesse Schenker is the chef. Jeff Gordonier, food writer for the New York Times, talks about what Jesse listens to while cooking and what various other chefs listen to while cooking. Soundcheck listeners, what do you listen to when you're whipping up dinner in your own kitchen? How does the music affect the menu, the meal? You can leave a comment on the Soundcheck page, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or call us, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692, or wnyc.org/soundcheck. Jesse, how does this soundtrack kind of affect the way your kitchen works?
For me, it's you know, I'm big into the nostalgia of the music. You know, it brings you back to when I was growing up, you know, in the early 90s. And I mean, I'm only 29, so it's like, you know, it's my era of music, so mm-hmm. to speak. I mean, that's what I grew up listening to. So basically, it puts me in a spiritual and an emotional state that's it's almost like a blank canvas, so to speak. So it brings me to a creative state that I can work from versus feeling chaotic or crazy in my own head. And it's kind of ironic to catch me too, because people think they listen to that music and why isn't it makes your head crazy, but it actually does the opposite for me.
Yeah.
And it kind of is like, you know, it's like a clear erase board where I can just kind of, you know, create from that point. And it makes me feel so great, you know?
Well, I think probably any home cook can relate to, you know, you want to hear something that's going to maybe put you in that in the zone, Jeff. I mean, you know, athletes talk about that. Why not chefs as well?
Absolutely. And food, you know, often is about friends and family, the people you're going to share the food with. And music is tied to that as well. I find there's certain albums I go back to over and over and over when I'm roasting a chicken. And if I don't have that music, it's somehow not as delicious.
Well, now, in your article, you quote Grant Achatz, the chef from Alinea in Chicago.
One of the great chefs in the world, yeah.
And he says that he had these two cellists playing while he and his team were sampling some, like, what was it, tomatoes?
Tomatoes. I believe they had blue cheese. And they had, like, a basil gelée. The thing with Grant is he wants to incorporate all the senses. I mean, this is taking dining to a whole nother level. And so, you know, the sense of touch, you often in one particular course, the diners at Alinea will eat everything with their fingers, or they sort of are drawn to do that. He's experimenting with lighting, color, all different things. And so sound is just part of that. And he wanted to – he did this experiment with two cellos to see how certain tonalities would affect the taste of like a tomato.
And?
Well, as he told me, when the cellists played sort of melodies and figures that sounded very sunny and summery, he felt like the tomato tasted riper. And now he's quite taken with this idea, and they're going to incorporate cellos into one of the courses at Alinea.
So two cellos does it for the chef Grant Achatz, as it did hundreds of years ago for Vivaldi. A little bit of Vivaldi's Concerto in G Minor for two cellos. Grant Achatz, the chef at Alinea in Chicago, toying with the idea of actually having two cellists play some original music, Jeff.
Well, in this case, yes, I believe they want to incorporate one cellist, but they have composed a piece of music that will be paired with the choreography of this one course, where they basically lay down a silicone tablecloth and smear the table very elegantly with all these dessert elements, garnishes, sauces. It's just like a Willy Wonka sweet dream. And so they wanted to have sort of a soundtrack, just as you would in a film. So Martin Kastner, one of the sort of design guys associated with the restaurant, has, working with a cellist, composed a piece of music that will be the soundtrack to that, which sounds amazing.
Jeff Gordonier's article for the New York Times about chefs and music came out this week. There's a link to it on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck, where you can leave your comments. What do you listen to when you're cooking? You can also call us, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Jesse Schenker also with us, chef at the West Village restaurant, Reset. So while you're, Jesse, listening to Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam in the kitchen, what are your diners hearing if they're far enough away from your open kitchen not to hear what you're hearing?
Well, you know, it's a tricky thing because, you know, the restaurant's small, and the purpose of the restaurant, you know, when I opened it was to have a restaurant where I would want to eat. You know, I wanted to really represent who I am. So music is a big part of my life. So there's got to be music playing. So now people are coming in and out. Some people, you know, we've experimented with this so much stuff. I mean, we did a Beatles soundtrack. We did, you know, we did Grateful Dead. We did, you know, we did newer stuff. We've tried. I mean, we've mixed and matched, and it's really became, you know, people. A lot of people walk out and they're like, oh, I love the music. Some people walk out, I hate the music. So it's like, oh my God, what's the perfect mix? So now I've been experimenting lately. Was doing like Foo Fighters with a little bit of Phil Collins. Because it's awkward, but like, you know, I said we talk around the kitchen, like Phil Collins never wrote a bad song, you know, like he really didn't, like every song, you know, every one of his songs, you always want to, you know, you play air drums to some of them, you know, you really get into it, and you know, and with it, Phil Collins Radio comes Journey, comes, you know, Styx, whatever else mixes in, it's all, it seems to be It seems to be working, so
we'll
see what.
Do you ever like survey the restaurant from the kitchen and see a whole bunch of people air drumming to In the Air Tonight? Or
I feel like in that one part though, like who wouldn't? You know,
right.
Like,
it's hard not to.
Exactly. Let's take some calls. Anderson's with us from Harlem. Hi, Anderson.
Yeah, hi. From the point of view of the diner, you know, when I go to eat out, I pay attention to the music that's playing in the restaurant, and mostly it's pleasant, it's suitable for eating. But there are some places that you want to run out of there because the music is so loud, you cannot even talk to somebody that's next to you. And more specifically, there's one place that I like. I love their hamburger in Midtown. I don't need to mention the name, but the music is so loud, the beat is so intense that it makes you so stressed eating there, at least is my experience, and I notice other people.
I think Anderson, that's really the point, is that this is a very personal kind of, you know, what works for Jesse may not work for you, and vice versa. And,
right, but it's the same with food. It's the same with the menu. I mean, you know, some people love tomatoes, some people hate tomatoes. So it's really, you know, your reality is your perspective. It is very personal.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break in a moment. But first, Bonnie from Long Island joining the conversation.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good. I'm not a professional chef, but I do a lot of cooking at home. And I usually listen to talk radio, either WNYC or I'll listen to This American Life.
we love you, Bonnie.
I know, it's how I keep track of time. I'm like, all right, I've been through 3 episodes of This American Life. I've just been a long time cooking. It kind of helps keeps me company when I'm cooking by myself. But as I've been sitting here listening to you take calls, I remember when my fiance and I first started dating, we would listen to the Beach Boys while cooking breakfast. And that's kind of a really wonderful memory. And every time I hear the Beach Boys now, I kind of think of that time and, you know, the first blush of the new love. So thanks, guys, for bringing back those memories for me.
All right, Bonnie, thank you very much. We'll take a quick break. And when we continue our look at music in the kitchen, in the restaurants, and in your kitchen. And we'll take more of your calls and comments. That's coming up on Soundcheck.
Oh, one day when you're looking back, you were young and mine, you were sad. When you're young.
Well, New York Times food writer Jeff Gordonier just can't marinate a pork shoulder without listening to this Ryan Adams album. And we'll hear more from him and from you as we continue with Soundcheck. Later on, Lala Brooks from the 1960s girl group The Crystals joins us for a look back on Soundcheck.
Somebody told me that his name was Bill. Then run, 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 let her run, run. Yes, the hearts are still. Yes, his name was Bill.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We've been talking about the role of music in today's top kitchens with the chef, Jesse Schenker, and with Jeff Gordonier of the New York Times. He wrote this article about chefs and music, which you can find on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Jeff, we're hearing Miles Davis in the background. There's an interesting story you tell about the high-end restaurant 11 Madison Park and Miles Davis, sort of.
And Miles sounds great, doesn't he? 11 Madison Park is a restaurant in Manhattan that kind of got 4 stars from the New York Times. And as soon as they did, they essentially detonated what the restaurant was and reinvented it. And have in every, you know, all evidence suggests they've been even more successful. The inspiration for doing that was Miles Davis. Now, as if you go in the kitchen at 11 Madison Park, you'll hear basically knives and silence. But philosophically, the inspiration for the magazine is Miles Davis.
For the restaurant.
Yeah. And so when you walk in the kitchen, there's this list of 11 words and phrases on the wall, framed, this big poster, and it's words and phrases they associate with Miles Davis and his muse and his ethos. Among those words, forward-moving, fresh, collaborative, spontaneous, adventurous. And that's essentially the mission statement for 11 Madison Park. Now, these guys from that restaurant, Daniel Hum and his team, have another restaurant recently opened called The Nomad, and that the entire inspiration for that restaurant is the Rolling Stones. So they have a whole list of words associated with the Rolling Stones for that one. It's fascinating.
And is the menu different?
At Nomad?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a different vibe, different design, different feeling altogether.
So Jesse, I mean, for you, if you were to open a second restaurant and do something different, would that mean different music? And I mean, does the genre of music and the genre of food sort of correlate for you?
Well, I feel like being in the West Village, small, it's almost okay. It's fitting. Hypothetically, if I had another restaurant and the atmosphere was different and I was, and it was a different part of town, I mean, I would be more fitting with the music. And I just appreciate talent when it comes to music. That could be driven by, Bob Dylan or whoever some of the greats are from back in the day. I mean, I couldn't put a genre on the music, but it would really define, the area and the atmosphere. And but again, it wouldn't be bad music. But again, that's perspective.
All right.
Well, that leaves open our questions about Phil Collins.
I wasn't going to go there, Jeff, but okay.
But I will.
Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? What do you listen to when you're cooking? What does music do for the process of making a meal? You can leave a comment, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or call us 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Kendall is on the line with us right here in New York. Hey, Kendall.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay.
Good. I'm so happy you all are talking about this. I literally just walked in the door, turned WNYC on, and I'm in the middle of opening. We're opening up my company, Kendall's Home Kitchen, in a couple of weeks on May 19th in Chappaqua, New York, and it's all about cooking with music and vibrations and love. And I literally just left opening boxes, and it's so true that the vibrations that we play around us actually do affect what we eat, because the water molecules in food absorb it. And I was talking with your producer, what most people will key in on is most people have seen the movie Like Water for Chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a scene in there where she's preparing a stew for her family, and she's not in a very good mood. And then they're eating it on the patio, and they all start weeping. And it just goes to show, you can try to do this. It's, probably recommend not trying to cook with anger, but even if you can just, while you're cooking, put love into it, you can say prayers, and just see how that affects you, because you will absorb the energies that are around you.
So
when you're eating,
it's an interesting idea that vibration. I mean, music is air vibrating.
Surprisingly, I heard echoes of the same thoughts from a lot of chefs, that they really felt that the music infused the food in a certain way, and certainly the camaraderie of the kitchen. I mean, if everyone in the kitchen is cooking along together, there's a good groove, they feel, in a sense, it's manifested in the food.
But again, it's important to say that a lot of times what's happening in the kitchen, and maybe, Jesse, your restaurant being a small restaurant with an open kitchen is an exception here, but most of the time you sit in a restaurant, you don't know what's going on back there,
right,
behind those doors.
You don't always want to know. Trust me.
All right. We've got comments coming in on the webpage. So Joel's got some of them in the control room. Joel?
John, our guest Jesse just mentioned Bob Dylan a few moments ago, and here's what our listener Gio in Brooklyn has to say. When I'm cooking, I always play Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, because that's the music my late brother loved, and I feel like I'm channeling him and presenting my food to him. Eating was a great pleasure to him. Ruth from Brooklyn writes, funny, I'm a huge hard rock and classic rock fan, but when I'm cooking, I prefer to listen to oldies and jazz standards. And Sonali from Brooklyn mentioned some recent guests here on Soundcheck that appeared last week. Rodrigo y Gabriela all the way. The rather frenetic pace of the music and the evolution and dynamism of their songs is amazing accompaniment to prepping a meal.
Rodrigo y Gabriela, the Mexican-based guitar duo. That was recorded live here in our studio on Soundcheck last week. And we are talking this week on Soundcheck today about chefs and music, about cooking with music and how music might perhaps even affect the way the food tastes. And my guests include Jeff Gordonier, food writer for The New York Times, and Chef Jesse Schenker of the West Village restaurant known as Reset. And joining us on the line, Joe from Long Island. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty well. So what's your experience been?
My experience is that, for as much as the chefs want to hear Bob Dylan or indie rock or, a lot of them want to listen to hip-hop, most of the people who they're working with, at least the workaday cooks who I know from when I was working in kitchens, they're mostly guys from Ecuador, from Puebla, Mexico, generally Latin guys. And they really kind of want to have nothing to do with a Bob Dylan song or, even a lot of the classic rock is kind of lost on them. And what I find that they want to listen to is local Spanish radio or tapes that they bring in from their home country. When I worked with a lot of guys from Puebla, they were bringing in cassette tapes that they had sent back from Mexico so that they could be listening to local radio
right
from far away, because that's what made them comfortable to work.
Now, that's the technology of a couple of years ago. Nowadays, it seems like it's an iPod and in an iPod dock.
That's
so
true.
So it really is one guy or one gal, sort of driving the train in terms
well,
of
Well, it
what
depends. Like, I noticed at Sorella on the Lower East Side, that in their tiny kitchen, which is not unlike the kitchen at Reset, there's this heap of iPods.
Oh.
Literally, there's like iPods all over the place. And as in many kitchens, there's sort of an afternoon race to the iPod dock to see who wins. And whoever's, whosoever shuffle is on there first wins. But it's absolutely true. Everyone in the kitchen often, there'll be just an incredible range of different tastes. Mm-hmm.
And different people from different
people.
Parts of the
Absolutely.
World, from different parts of the Americas. Speaking of different parts of America, Kim is joining us from Colorado Springs. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Music and food, how does it go together for you?
Well, I just remember growing up, my mom would always have, when she's cleaning house or baking, she'd have Trini Lopez and Brothers Four and Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. And mm-hmm. So now when I cook with my kids, those are the ones that I pull out because that's what my memory is. And I have a 13-year-old that loves Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass now because of that. And it's kind of fun to carry on that music and baking tradition.
And so that music becomes a part of the whole family routine of making and sharing a meal, which is that's a great thing.
There's a sushi restaurant up in Ardsley in Westchester County where I happen to live, and they play Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass all the time. And my kids, who are 6 and 9 years old, love it. Love it. That's like their favorite music, too.
What about, hip-hop is obviously a dominant musical force.
Dominant.
Outside of kitchens. What about inside kitchens?
I saw that all over the place. I mean, there's one restaurant, a sandwich shop called Bauhaus on 14th Street that's run by Eddie Wang. And hip-hop's a huge part of his whole personal gestalt. And so much so that Eddie made hip-hop a factor in hiring when he was opening the place. It's true. He put in ads in Craigslist with these cryptic snippets of lyrics from various hip-hop songs, like Play Nintendo with Cesar Leo from a Notorious B.I.G. song. And if you didn't know what it meant or you didn't know what it was a reference to, you might not fit in. So that's how it was sort of self-selective that way.
Yeah, I would think so. So Eddie Wang's Bauhaus, if you want to work there, it helps to be familiar with Cameron, featuring Prodigy. My flow and my whole game been tight. Buns and pearls, your tongue will twirl. Look at here, booger beer, I have you up and hook a gear. I swear, I was doing, let's pursuing. Be wide like Western Union, short like next to you. I repent from Troy, only set was roaring, but phony checks are flowing. Listen, hear me out, I'm from a pain block with some plain clothes cops. And the sun don't rise, but the rain don't stop. The pain don't stop, but my brain don't stop. And no lockouts, the game don't stop. Every month you change your locks, change your spot. Get a little smart, want to change. Cameron featuring Prodigy and Losing Weight. And that's the kind of thing that'll get you in the door at Eddie Wang's restaurant called Bauhaus. Once again, Jeff Gordonier's article for The New York Times on music and chefs can be found on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Chef Jesse Schenker of the West Village Restaurant Reset also with me, and Delmore on the line with us from Manhattan. Hi, Delmore.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What years you got ago, for us?
Years ago on the far west side in the 50s, there was a place called the Skyline Motel. And one of the things they featured in their dining room was a waiter, a dancing musical waiter, who would prepare the Cherry's Jubilee on a flambé cart to the tune of the Russian Saber Dance.
Uh-huh. That sounds
people
terrifying.
People came just for the dessert.
So this is the Aram Khachaturian piece. A saber dance. Yeah, that does sound kind of scary, but yeah, people would show up just for that. Laura on the line with us from New Jersey. I understand, hi. Laura, that you are a chef yourself.
Yeah, hi. I am. And I'm also an art therapist by training. And I was mentioning to the screener that I actually wrote my master's thesis on using cooking and cooking with other people as a therapeutic modality. And I love listening to your show. I think it's awesome. I think I would never be able to cook without listening to music.
Mm-hmm.
Since I first started cooking, which was with my mom and my sister, we would always listen to Billie Holiday's Lady in Satin, like as a tradition, mm-hmm. one of the best albums ever.
Not a bad place to start a meal from. And I think I think that's kind of the point that we're getting. Laura, thanks for the call, is that, you know, the kind of mood that you're in, if the music is setting you off, Jesse, on the right foot, it's going to be a good day in the kitchen.
If we feel good, the food's going to taste better.
Mm. All right. The Jesse Schenker's restaurant is Reset in the West Village. Jeff Gordonier's article for the New York Times on music and chefs is on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Jeff told us this morning that, and I'm going to quote your email here, Jeff, even the hippest and most badass of kitchens, there is often a moment when the soundtrack switches to She's Gone or Rich Girl by Hall & Oates. All right, if you say
it happened.
So. Jeff, Jesse, thank you guys for being with us on Soundcheck.
Thanks a lot.
And you're going too far, because you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money. It's a bitch.
Still to come, Lala Brooks was the voice behind 60s hits like Da Do Ron Ron and Then He Kissed Me. She joins us next on Soundcheck.
Guest time on American Bandstand, and I have had the distinct pleasure of traveling many, many thousands of miles with these young ladies as we go about the country making personal appearances. They've got a brand new record, a thing called Little Boy. Ladies and gentlemen, let's greet the Crystals.
Little boy, you probably don't know me.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last week, when longtime American Bandstand host Dick Clark died, fans responded with memories of watching their favorite groups on the show. But for Lala Brooks of the Crystals, it was a moment to remember being on the show back in 1964 with this song, Little Boy. In fact, Lala Brooks made many appearances with Dick Clark, as well as on the Billboard charts and in venues all across the country. Lala Brooks joins us on Soundcheck. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. When was the last time you were actually in touch with Dick Clark?
Oh, my goodness. This was about some years back when I was older. Mm-hmm. I was in Vienna. I lived in Vienna for 8 years. And my son saw him in New York and called me in Vienna and said he spoke to Dick Clark. And Dick Clark and Carrie said they were coming to Vienna for a 5-week vacation. And Dick Clark called me, and him and I and Carrie had dinner together.
So how important was he for your career?
Oh, my God, Dick Clark was such a sweetheart. He was so important for American Bandstand and just playing our records. And I did many shows with Dick Clark,
mm-hmm.
called The Caravan of Stars. And when everyone, some of the artists used to get sick, Dick used to come to me and say, Lala, could you fill in for everybody? I'd fill in for anybody. Because I was only 15 at the time, so I was like the ham, you know?
Uh-huh. Soundcheck listeners, you can find a video of Lala and the Crystals on American Bandstand. It's on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. So you hit it big pretty early, you know, with the Crystals. I mean, 1963, "Do Do Ron Ron" goes to number three on the charts. Now, as I understand it, you would kind of swap who was singing lead, who was singing harmony or background. You're the lead on "To Do Run Run,"
yeah,
right?
I'm the lead on "To Do Run Run," and then he kissed me. But I started with the Crystals when I was 13 in Brooklyn. All of us was from Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did "To Do Run Run." I recorded that when I was 15 with Phil.
And in Phil being Phil Spector.
Phil Spector, yeah.
And in the background, the one of the backing singers on this is Cher?
Well, yes, Cher's on "To Do Run Run" because Phil only flew me out to California to put down the tracks on "To Do Run Run," and then he kissed me, "Little Boy, Girls Can Tell." He didn't bring the original girls out, so they had different singers on background. And Cher is on "To Do Run Run Run, To Do Run Run."
1963 hit from The Crystals with lead vocals by my guest Lala Brooks. Do Run Run, that Phil Spector wall of sound. But at the front of that wall is my guest Lala Brooks, lead singer for The Crystals on this and a number of other songs of theirs. You said you were 15 when you made this recording?
I was 15, and I was 13 when I joined the group.
Now, how does a 13-year-old in Brooklyn
you
know, become a chart-topping singer?
Well, you know, I was in a school called PS73, and Dee Dee Kennebrew, which was the original background singer for the Crystals, her mother, Mrs. Henry, worked in my school. And after school program, the mother used to be there. And my mother didn't allow us to play on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, if you want to go, you know, and have fun, go back to school after 3 o'clock. And that's where I heard this guy playing. His name was Leo. And I heard him playing, "Gee Whiz, Look at His Eyes." And I liked that song, "Gee Whiz." And I just followed the music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I followed the music, I stood in a door and I said, "Can I sing?" And he said, "Can you?" And I said, "Yeah." And Dee Dee Kennebrew's mom, Mrs. Henry, heard me. And she came down the hall and she said to me, "Was that the girl with the little girl like you with a big voice?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "How would you like to sing with the Crystals?" And I said, "Okay, you know."
So I joined them then. What were the Crystals at that point? Were they just like a high school group?
They were high school. Well, they sang. Well, they at that particular time, they had "There's No Other Like My Baby" out, just one hit. And then from that day on, I was on everything with them on Uptown, but I was on background.
Mm-hmm.
And Barbara did "There's No Other Like My Baby." And then I started doing "There's No Other Like My Baby" on stage because I was the ham and Barbara was afraid. So then I did "There's No Other Like My" on stage and Uptown. And then Phil realized that I had a big voice. And then he took me out to California to sing.
So I understand, you know, you're in a high school, there's a band, and one of the kids' mothers hears you. That all makes sense. How does Phil Spector, one of the most storied producers in the history of pop music, come into the picture?
Well, he was recording us at the time. He was in New York, and his apartment was on York Avenue, and we were in New York recording with Phil. Phil went out to California later, and people don't realize that Phil and the Crystals were the first ever artist that Phil had.
Mm-hmm.
And then came Darlene Love and Ronnie Spector and the Righteous Brothers. But he started in New York with us.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went out to California. So we really started Phil Spector.
So when you started, did you have any, or did your parents, did your mom have any trepidation about you being out, you know, performing and eventually flying across the country with this guy and stuff?
No, I don't think she did. I think that, I came from gospel. I was seven. I used to sing gospel in church when I was 7 years old. So she knew I could sing.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, I was like maybe 12 and a half when Dee Dee's mother went to ask my mom, and then I turned 13. But I had a guardian. I was the youngest in the group, and I had a guardian, which was one of the girls, Patsy Wright's mom, and she traveled with me every place. I was protected. Then I left the PS73, and I went to junior high school. In high school, I went to school with Patty Duke, Duncan Quinn, which is Andy Quinn's son. Mm. I went to school with George Washington's, Dinah Washington's son, and so many famous
artists. Bernadette Peters?
Bernadette Peters was in my school. And so I went to school, junior high and high school with professional children.
Right, right. And so do you remember that first recording when you did Uptown, when you were still singing back up? Do you remember that first session?
Oh, sure. I can remember Barbara in the booth and Phil driving us crazy. And
why, making you do it again and again?
Oh, again. I feel so sorry for Barbara, you know, because I was background singing. The funniest thing is that I was young, but I had that gospel big voice. And Phil used to put the girls, the original Crystals, when he was in New York, on the mic. Barbara used to be in the booth. And he used to put me in back of the girls, a few feet away, is because for me singing gospel, I didn't know how to balance my voice because I was just so, you know.
You were just belting it out.
And he was saying, put Lala all the way in the back so she could do the harmony.
There was a method to his madness, as it turns out, because the Crystals, young as they were, went to number 13 on the Billboard chart with Uptown.
He's a little man, but then he comes up.
The Crystals with Uptown, a 1962 hit produced by Phil Spector, and among the voices in The Crystals, Lala Brooks, my guest on Soundcheck. She's performing in a tribute to Carole King at Joe's Pub this week here in New York with The Losers Lounge and Ira Kaplan from the band Yola Tengo. That's tonight through Saturday night. You can find details on the Soundcheck page, wnyc.org/soundcheck. So Lala, you're a teenager, you're beginning to tour around, and eventually you start touring the South.
Yeah.
Now, what was that like? I mean, so you're still finding segregation in effect and stuff. What was that like?
That was difficult for me as a teenager because, as I said, coming from Brooklyn and being able to go in the restaurants, and when Dick Clark was on tour with us, Dick Clark was so gracious. We couldn't sometimes go in the restaurants to eat. And Dick Clark used to let his service guy, his name was Ed. I remember so much. His name was Ed, and he would go and get the sandwiches and take notes of what we wanted. But I think that was very difficult for me as a teenager because I became confused.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, you know, I remember going home to my mom and my dad, and my dad was from the South. My mom was from the North. And being 13, I would stand up in the living room and say, you know, what happened to me, and my dad was Southern. And he would say, Dolores, Lala, now you can't bother them white folks because they're going to do not a lot for you. And I used to get so angry. And I said, Dad, but I couldn't go into the restaurant. He says, it's going to be all right, you know. So I really, it had an effect on me. But I learned when you get older, you know, I never was bitter. I never was angry. I was young and confused because I couldn't understand when I worked with Sam Cooke and Otis Redding and people like that on stage. And the stage was in the middle, and white people were on one end, and black people were on the other. And they had those big mics, and I used to have to pick them up. I'm on, damn, my heart's still to do, run, and keep turning. And I remember asking Sam Cooke, why? You know, why is it like that? And then I was more confused is because when we finished the show with Sam Cooke, and we work with Sam a lot, and when I come outside in the South, the kids my age are older. 17, 16, they said, y'all the crystals? Could we have your autograph? Mm-hmm. And I remember saying no. Because, you know, I was young. Yeah. And Dee Dee and them, the original girls, would say, Lala, just give me the autograph. But by me being a lead singer, I had a little weight that I tried to use. I'm saying that I don't think that's right, but as being young, you just don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Because you figure, I'm performing and I can't, you know, look at you guys together, and you come and ask me for my autograph, I was confused.
So even the audiences were segregated?
Yeah.
Wow.
And even the bathrooms, I mean, after when we would perform and you would perform for them and they really loved us because, you know, they thought we were white. They didn't think we were black.
Until you showed up.
Until we showed up.
Oh, I see.
And I remember showing up in a car and some of the girls would say, oh, they're not, them some white girls, them some black girls, they ain't white. You know, and because Uptown, you know, those songs sound more white.
Yeah.
There wasn't the Motown sound.
What about Then He Kissed Me, which, you know, was such a huge hit. Again, your lead vocals on this, I mean, this is 1963. Did people still think that the Crystals were a kind of a white girl group?
Yeah, they thought we were white. They did. Barbara did the lead on that. And they thought, and I copied it after, I recorded after, but they thought we were white because, as I said, we didn't have that heavy Motown sound.
Yeah.
And Carole King wrote that, and she wrote it for Little Eva, wrote it about Little Eva. She let us do it, but she wrote it for Little Eva because Little Eva was being abused by her boyfriend.
Oh, okay, so now you're talking about he
hit me.
He hit me, but it felt like a kiss.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is a different song from Then He Kissed Me.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay,
so sorry.
But go ahead with, you know, so this, so he
no,
hit
then
me and
he
it felt like a kiss.
Okay. Well,
so it's Carole King and she wrote it about Little Eva.
Yeah. I thought we were talking about like he hit me. Excuse me. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. We can circle back to the other one, but go ahead.
He Hit Me was written for us and Carole King wrote it for Little Eva because Little Eva was her babysitter. And Little Eva would come to her house and she would be abused, like beat up. And she started questioning her and asked her, what is wrong? What, you know, why is your boyfriend doing this to you? And she would have the answer that, well, he still loves me. He loves me. And then Carole King and Jerry Goffin got together and wrote He Hit Me. And that's what we recorded. And it was, at that particular time, when it was released, it was put out, but they stopped it because we were teenagers and the lyrics was so, you know,
it's still
crazy.
It's still crazy. A pretty controversial song.
Exactly.
1962, it's the Crystals with He Hit Me, It Felt Like a Kiss. Lala Brooks is my guest, singing backup on this track.
Yeah.
He hit me, and it felt like a kiss. He hit me, but it did.
Felt Like a Kiss, 1962 song, written by the great songwriting team of Carole King and Jerry Goffin, and recorded by The Crystals, my guest Lala Brooks, lead vocalist on so many of The Crystals' hits, and you sing this song now, although you were back up on the original recording.
Yeah.
Once again, Lala is doing part of this tribute to Carole King this week at Joe's Pub with the Losers Lounge and Ira Kaplan from the band Yola Tango. That's tonight through Saturday. Details on our webpage. Actually, it's tonight through Friday. Details on the webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. So He Hit Me, It Felt Like a Kiss, 1962. Then 1 year later, the clouds part, and you head to the top of the charts, and this time you are singing lead on Then He Kissed Me.
Yeah, Then He Kissed Me, I did lead on.
Now, the story is that you didn't like this song at first.
No, I didn't. I really didn't, maybe because I was used to a little bit more up-tempo, and maybe because the lyrics was so difficult for me because I was so young and I didn't understand the lyrics. So I just didn't like it at first. But then after, you know, it had to grow on me. But Jack Nitzsche and Phil just went crazy over it, and Jack Nitzsche loved it.
He was the engineer, right?
Jack Nitzsche was the engineer.
Yeah. and of course Phil Spector, the producer.
Exactly.
This is the classic Phil Spector wall of sound. Sound.
Yeah.
the hit song "Then He Kissed Me." La Brooks and the Crystals, "Then He Kissed Me," a huge hit in 1963. The Crystals' La La would break up in 1966, and then you've already mentioned working with Sam Cooke and Otis Redding,
yeah.
But you would go on to work with the Neville Brothers and
yeah.
Isaac Hayes
yeah.
and so many others. The stories you could tell and probably have told.
Yeah.
You had your own radio show while living in Vienna?
Yeah, I did. I had my own radio show. See, after I left the Crystals, I went in the original cast in Hair on Broadway. I did Aquarius. And I did Two Gentlemen of Verona with Clifton Davis and Raul Julia. And then I started recording my own stuff with the Neville Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I had my own radio show in Vienna for 2.5 years.
Well, it's great to have you on our little radio show. Thank you, Lala Brooks, for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's going to do it for today's show. Tomorrow, the Broadway production End of the Rainbow explores the troubled final months in the life of the actress and singer Judy Garland. We'll talk with Tracy Bennett, who plays Garland in this musical drama. And we'll present the latest band in our Blind Date series. You could find True Musical Love tomorrow on Soundcheck. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. The program is produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn with Margaret Bresnahan. Our senior producer, Joel Meyer. We had help today from Gina Gildasis. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.